The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. Hi, everyone. I am Sarah Edmondson, and I'm here with...
Hi, I'm Anthony Ames, Sarah's husband, a.k.a. Nippy.
And we're here to talk about things that are a little bit culty. Speaking of, we were in a cult, and we woke up, thank goodness, and we have a lot to say.
And a lot to ask.
This podcast is going to be a deep dive into everything from the red flags to the narcissism, the manipulation, the resiliency, the recovery process, and everything in between. Also, we want to share some of the good we got out of it so you can get all the nuggets without having to join a cult.
If you haven't already, because there are a lot of things out there that are just a little bit culty.
Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about the fads, beliefs, and trends that blur the line between healthy and a little bit culty. Please subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And find us on Instagram if you have any suggestions for things you have found to be a little bit culty. Good morning.
It is a good morning.
Thanks for this coffee you made me.
Honey in my coffee.
I just like to point out that Nippy made me a really good cup of coffee and he said, yeah, it's better than your swill.
Yeah. Sticking my guns on that one.
This day started off rough, but I have a feeling things are just going to pick up.
Keep drinking my coffee.
Smooth from now on. We have such a great guest lined up and he's wicked smart.
Wicked smart.
And this is going to be a serious one. But before we get into that, we had some less serious things to discuss, just sharing what we've been up to.
What?
Well, I haven't told you this yet. One of the great joys for me as a parent
is... You're
not
pregnant, are you?
No, I'm not pregnant.
Jesus Christ.
We're stopping it too. I mean, we'd love to have another child, but it's just not realistic.
Shit out of me.
No. One of the greatest joys for me as a parent is introducing Troy, now that he's almost seven, to some of the movies that were important for me growing up, like doing Princess Bride with him and other cult classics. And speaking of cults, since this is a little bit culty, last night I showed him Pitch Perfect. Something happened and I thought this would be a fun thing to show him. And as I was watching it, and I haven't watched it since it came out, I was like, oh my God. This a cappella group and the dynamics around it are a little bit culty. And then, of course, I was like thinking about Keith coming up with the idea for DOS and maybe he watched Pitch Perfect and stole the idea of blindfolding the girls who were joining this, you know, a cappella club to blindfold them and welcome them. And they even shake hands and say, you know, welcome to the Bard and Bella's with all the responsibilities, which is actually the same thing we would say when people got promoted to the rank of coach and proctor. Welcome to the rank of coach with all the responsibilities and privileges that entails. And then you like, you know, do all the bowing. Anyway, and then also the leader of the, maybe he's looking at me like, where are you going with this? But I'm telling you.
We're holding back on?
No, this is a thing. So Anna Camp, who plays Aubrey Posen, the leader of the Bard and Bella's, was super bossy and no one could question her or else they'd get kicked out. And I'm telling you, this is where it all starts, the sorority of the a cappella, which leads me to something that I don't think was discussed in any of the documentaries. Maybe it was, I'd have to go back, but did you remember that Keith was obsessed with a cappella?
Yeah, I don't, I guess.
He started Simply Human, which by the way, Nippy behind closed doors called,
I didn't even do it behind closed doors.
But what did you call it?
Simply Stupid.
Yes, he called a cappella, the Nexium a cappella group, Simply Stupid.
And the they were good. The same show for 12 years.
Well, the first time we heard them perform, which was at Nancy's birthday, also called The Follies, where people presented skits and stuff for her as a tribute or present. The first time I heard Simply Human, I'd never actually heard an a cappella group before, and I was blown away. Anyway, cut to... I want to say 2007, yeah. Somewhere around there. So Claire and Keith created Acapella Innovations, which was basically an acapella championship, whatever, where college acapella groups were invited from around the U.S. to come and perform at the Egg. So they had a huge acapella contest, and it didn't really go anywhere because the university students were savvy and were on Reddit and were researching Keith and basically called him out for using Acapella Innovations as a recruitment for the cult. But Simply Human existed from that point on.
What happened is they tried to enroll everyone into a 5-day or something like that.
Yeah, he was using it for recruitment, which at the time we didn't see that as a bad thing. It was like, it was just an opportunity to meet new people, to join the team humanity. But I think it was just his way of tapping into the college girls.
Yeah, probably. Hey, the recording that you have of Ace last night in the car.
Yeah.
We're
going to play that.
This is Ace's first sentence.
He said a couple of sentences, but this is definitely.
This is pretty devastating.
What did you say? What the what?
What the fuck?
What was that, Ace?
What the fuck?
My God.
What
the fuck? What the fuck?
All right, that's enough. Are you proud or embarrassed?
Are you proud as
a parent?
Well, here's
we have
the,
a guest.
Here's the segue. What I say to Keith about trying to recruit college students through acapella. What the fuck? Also, what the fuck is going on in our world right now? We are a little bit overwhelmed with the amount of things that are culty, and we're hoping that our next guest is going to be able to help us discern some of these things and give us more tools for analyzing what is culty and what is an actual cult. So if you've listened to the Conspirituality podcast, which is my new favorite podcast, you already know that it is like a weekly masterclass on a whole Venn diagram of all things culty, conspiracy theories, and spirituality. It's a deep, deep dive.
Yeah, what I like about it is they articulate the issues in ways that add to the growing library of language that I think is necessary in understanding how groups like these thrive. The more conversations that happen, the more people understand it and recognize it. And the way they articulate these things have helped me get a deeper grasp on it.
It's intense. I mean, just listen to this log line from the Conspirituality podcast website. A journalist, a cult researcher, and a philosophical skeptic discuss the stories, cognitive dissonances, and cultic dynamics tearing through the yoga, wellness, and new spirituality worlds.
We knew we had to talk to the Conspirituality crew, especially because we've been getting so many requests to explore things like yoga, QAnon, anti-vax, and all kinds of different new age spirituality culty stuff on the podcast.
So we reached out, and Matthew Remsky from Conspirituality answered our bat signal. And we're so glad that he did.
He's an author, an investigative journalist, a dad, and he also happens to be a 2-time survivor of yoga-related cults. Here's our conversation with Matthew Remsky.
Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Good morning, Matthew. How are you?
I'm good. Good to see you, Sarah. Good to see you, Nippy.
Likewise, Matthew.
What a treat. Thank you for agreeing to do this with us. In preparation for this interview, we realized that
this could go anyway.
This could go in so many different directions because we recognize there's just so much going on, and we don't even know where to start, to be totally honest.
We have an idea.
We have an idea, obviously, but we were prepping with you 2 days ago, and then our head started spinning because it feels like there's literally no end to hot topics and things that are just really hard for us to understand right now. With the alt-right and the new age horseshoeing towards each other, as you put it, and disinformation and this whole sea of charismatic influencers with, TikTok accounts, and QAnon and CrossFit and burger joints and self-help classes. So the question is that we want to start with, is everything just cultier than ever right now? Or is it just us? Or are we just seeing it clearly for the first time? So welcome to A Little Bit Culty. And our first burning question for you is, hey, Matthew, what the fuck's going on?
It's a great question. And I think it's a little bit of all of the above. plus the fact that, and I think this podcast is a bit of a testimony to that, we're kind of in a golden age of cult media. And I think that's because of a couple of factors. The brick and mortar organizations that were famous for honing cultic abuse techniques in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, their VHS archives have slowly made it into digital format. The Me Too era enabled a lot of, especially women survivors, to speak out. And there's also just a proliferation of independent media production. And I think it's really revealing the fact that when people start talking about their lives and they happen to be in their 40s and 50s, they have a lot to say about the toxic social dynamics that they were involved with and they didn't necessarily see clearly. So are things cultier? I think definitely with the advent of digital cultism, we see greater impacts of cultic dynamics, but also more diffuse and unstable impacts. You know, the people who were fully signed on to QAnon will have to go through a recovery process, of course, but it's not like the situation that you both were in the sense that the relationships that they had were all parasocial.
Sorry, what does parasocial mean?
It's kind of like the one-sided relationship that the individual has with the celebrity influencer.
Ah.
Or with a mass media phenomenon, then they might think that they are personally engaged with a group of people, but really the attention all flows one way. So anyway, we can get into QAnon a little bit later, but I think that there's two things. We've had a proliferation of cultic techniques and a normalization of cultic techniques into mm-hmm. various economic sectors. And then we've also had a lot of reporting, independent reporting from people who've survived these environments.
You know, one of the impressions that I have, and I don't know if you're saying this in a different way, is that there have been kind of these subversive influences going on already, but because of this information age and disinformation age and the way content is digested, more long form interviews tend to be juxtaposed with just the sound speak or the talk speak that we've been getting. And in getting all this information, people are starting to recognize through comparison that a lot of the things that we've been fed through three networks, mostly for half of our lives, if in your 40s or 50s, has been poisoned with a subversive way to get us to think and behave a certain way. You know, what you see in the polarities of the media, you know, you turn on one network reporting on an event and another network reporting on the event, and it's extreme. This desperation between these networks to keep their viewers, and long form interviews tend to be more informative. And so you're going to see the extremities come out as they're desperately trying to keep their viewers or eyeballs, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think there are some categorical differences that you're pointing to. The long form interview, which is kind of what we're doing right now, is going to be more relational and confessional. You know, I'm going to try to back up everything that I say with resources, but often it's in a kind of commentarial mode that doesn't necessarily add to people's confidence in their epistemology or how they actually know what is true, but it does begin to make stronger relationships with people. Mm. But I think that what we struggle with as cult survivors or people who have been through high demand groups is that it's very difficult to know who is backing up what they say and with what. And so I think that the three of us on this call have had enough experience with liars, mm-hmm. deceivers, manipulators, and people who specifically aren't just lying, deceiving, and manipulating, but they're telling a particular story about the world in very broad strokes, that when you come out of that environment, anybody who seems to be telling a broad story about the world becomes a little bit suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's happened to the fragmentation of media and journalism, I think, is its own separate topic, and it's parallel to the path of cultic involvement and recovery over the last 30 years. They definitely interact.
We have that on our list, and we're going to circle back to that shortly. But before we get to that, two questions. If you could define conspirituality as a concept for our listeners.
You know what? I actually have a reference for your listeners, which is that in 2011, the term was defined by Charlotte Ward and David Voas in a paper. David Voas is a professor of religious studies, and he's a sociologist, and Ward is an independent researcher. And they noticed in 2011, and probably in the 2 years leading up to it, that there was a growing convergence between female-dominated New Age spirituality discourse and male-dominated, more cynically oriented and focused on global politics, conspiratorial discourse. And they talk about the merger of those two forces, the sort of handshake and waltz that those two forces do together as being conspirituality. Mm. And there's really two steps in it, in that dance. And one is the general conspiratorial conviction that something terrible is happening in the world and that we're at a crisis point and, you know, things are falling apart, but that the fact that things are falling apart represents a mystical opportunity for personal transformation, which can be aided along or, you know, midwived or whatever by the individual's participation in spiritual activity. And so in one hand, like, in spirituality is kind of like it's a double-bladed knife, because on one hand, it is describing this terrible world that is out for you and that is perilous and that is filled with horrible forces that are conspiring against you, and they want to defile you and they want to, you know, eat your babies and whatever. And on the other hand, the facing up to that reality mm-hmm. is a call to love and renewal that, you know, the influencer can provide, right? So the conspiritualist mm-hmm. is really good at scaring the shit out of people on one day and then love bombing them the next. And just to put that into context, like, to give a really solid example of that, I don't know if you watched Plandemic when yep. it came out,
yep.
But it was produced by a guy named Mickey Willis, who went from New Age filmmaking. I think he was involved in the production of The Secret, and then he had his own film company. Anyway, he's been a media guy for a long time, and it kind of shows. He's very good at it. And he releases Plandemic on May 4th or something like that. It goes viral.
Mm-hmm.
It's a horrifying, wherever you stand on COVID or vaccines or wherever, the story of the movie is terrifying. It is a horror film, right? And as people are freaking out and watching it, it's going viral. Mickey takes to his Facebook 2 days later, and he gives this sermon into the camera where he's tearful and he's talking. He's sort of lit like an angel. There's beautiful golden light behind him.
Right.
It's like Mark Vicente could not have made him look better than, right? Like, so he gives this weepy sermon about how he loves his viewers, how he's in it with them, how he's willing to die for this cause, which he never quite articulates. It's like content free. But what's happening is that 2 days before, he drops this sort of horror show onto the New Age wellness demographic. Everybody's terrified of Tony Fauci and vaccines and whatever. And then 2 days later, he presents himself basically as Jesus Christ and says, our togetherness, our community is going to make everything well. You're going to stand with me. And that's really the conspiritualist sort of double-handed bait and switch.
So to right. sum it up, we have structures, hierarchies in our society, and they're all vulnerable to abuses. Conspirituality is kind of the way you would articulate the spiritual realm is being abused or being subverted. Would that be a good way to sum it up?
I think that conspiritualists are really, really good at capitalizing upon moral panics.
Right.
And as we've seen, a public health crisis.
Right. So if I'm a banker, I get inside information. That's how I abuse it. If I'm a conspiratorist, I'm good at pulling the heartstrings in the same way.
That's exactly okay. it. And to pull heartstrings that you are already really tied around your finger, because it's not like the messaging of these folks is significantly different from how they have been selling their spirituality programs beforehand or how they've been selling their wellness products beforehand. What COVID does, what, you know, the lead up to the 2020 election does, is it just raises the stakes for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so if you've been selling a set of spiritual solutions for life's problems, What greater Waterloo moment would there be than a public health crisis? Mm-hmm. To prove the value of your content? I mean, we can only imagine what Ranieri would have come up with.
I was going to say that.
In relation to COVID. One of the reasons that I'm really glad, this is a very banal reason for being glad that he's in jail, is that we don't have to hear what his like ridiculous answer to COVID would be, because he would have one and it would be into a course. And then, you know, there'd be like a, there'd be a series of courses on the immune system and shit, right?
Absolutely. Actually, probably. I bet you if I put Nippy on the spot right now, he could come up with a word salad answer to. So Keith, what's happening with COVID? Can you give us an answer? Can you advise us? He's really good at impressions, by the way. Watch this, Matthew.
Oh, it would be something to the effect of, it's interesting. One might say that the virus is an internal crisis. However, if we all go onto the internet and we're on our social media platforms, would it then become an external crisis?
So oh my God.
We're then inherently dealing with not only something internally, which could be very real, yet we're dealing with something that we have to deal through externally that affects everyone. So now, and he'd come up with whatever he'd want us to do.
Oh my God. See, I mean, it's, and this is so perfect because how, the point is not the data. The point is not the content.
It's just word salad.
It's for you to capture my attention. Yeah. It's the essence of bullshitting, which is actually, I don't know if you know, like that, it's a philosophical term. Harry Frankfurt defines it as, it's the person whose purpose for speaking is to make an impression. They don't actually really care about whether or not what they're saying is true. It might be true. It might not be true. They're not lying, right? They're actually spinning something plausible around the capture of intention. So that's perfect, Nippy. I'm so haunted. Look, I'm so, are you okay? Does that happen to you on a daily basis?
No, here's the thing.
Ask him to do it. I find it amusing.
It's cathartic.
Well, it was a cathartic when I was in. I'd leave a forum and I'd go, what did he just fucking say? Like, and I would imitate it. And I'd be like, so what did I just say? And I kind of leave it, but I didn't necessarily have the awareness that I was calling bullshit on him. And one of the things that we talked about in one of our other conversations that we had the other day was, and I'd love for you to comment on this, what he was particularly clever at was making this seem like a benign job of helping people.
Right.
I don't know. You seem to articulate that better than I had. And it's actually an awareness for me when you said it. Do you remember what you said when?
Yeah, we were speaking earlier. And I think what I said was that from all I've seen from the media and the news reporting and looking at the court stuff is that he was extremely good at normalizing and domesticating the cultic dynamic.
That was the word.
Into a business model. Yes. That looked like the rest of the corporate world.
Yes.
Although, what was its product? It was selling the image of itself as coaching people to be in that world so that they could coach other people to be in that world. So it was also parasitical in the sense that there wasn't really a product being manufactured.
Right.
It was interesting because even the product itself, I think he tried to make it sound substantial through the uses of the words, usages of the words like tech, right?
And testimonials.
And testimonials, right. There's something so parallel to the corporate feeling environment of those scenes that the whole world has seen now in The Vow, and what they might expect at, I don't know, an Amazon shareholders meeting or like a Google or a tech bro staff meeting in Silicon Valley or something like that, where there's a lot of sort of management aspirational jargon. And so the real terrifying abuse at the heart of Keith Raniere's soul was wrapped up in layer after layer of banal, flat, IKEA-styled, suburban, like, it was very normal, very normalized. And I haven't seen anything like that. Like, he was super good at making this thing seem like there was nothing fringe about it whatsoever.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. I want to ask you some yoga NXIVM questions, but before I do, I realized I am remiss. I meant to ask from the beginning, can you quickly give us, because we don't want to focus too much on this, your story is out there already, but for our listeners who don't know you that well yet, give us a little bit of your story of how you got in and how you got out.
That's a great way of asking, because I'm sure you've both been confronted with, why did you join? So 1996, I would have been 25 years old. And I was a long way from home. I was alienated from my family. I was probably clinically depressed. I had no sort of family culture of, well, you could go to therapy or, you know, you could seek out some sort of help or support. And a guy named Michael Roach rolled through town, the small town that I was living in Vermont. And he was running a burgeoning cult at that point called the Asian Classics Institute. He taught a form of kind of prosperity. Well, it turned out to be prosperity gospel Tibetan Buddhism, which is kind of strange, but we didn't know that at the time. I thought that I was signing up for two things: some kind of intact, pre-modern spiritual tradition that I could begin to understand, that might reconnect me with my vestigial Catholic mysticism from childhood. But I also thought that I was joining up with a person who had figured out how to completely renovate their lives. And I think my particular sort of self-image at that point was so crashed that that was particularly attractive to me. But how they got me, or how he got me, was by really deceiving us with his biography, with his training, with his skill and fluency in medieval Tibetan scripture. And that started, you know, three and a half years or so of intensive engagement, a lot of emotional labor, a lot of financial abuse, and having his reality really take over my internal sense and my internal guidance, as is not uncommon. And, you know, your podcast might be a sort of kind of a networking tree for figuring out how this works in your situation. I actually wound up in another group immediately after leaving Michael's group, because I was kind of stranded in Europe with, you know, even more or less social connections than I had had before, with less professional opportunity as I've, you know, as I'd given up my schooling to pursue this. There was 3 years that I spent at a place called Endeavor Academy, because I made a phone call, I think, from Heathrow Airport to an old friend of mine in Vermont. And he had said to me once that, Charles Anderson, or the master teacher at Endeavor Academy, he really opened my heart up and he really showed me who I was as a human being. And I remembered that as I was kind of desperate.
Wow. Yeah.
In many ways alone. And I phoned him and I said, who is the guy and where is it? And he told me, and I went, and then within 3 weeks, I had sort of slid my way into another high demand situation. What I wanted to say, I was anticipating this question. What I want to say is that if you haven't fully covered this question of, like, how did you join? I just want to be clear as a researcher that we don't have any data that really is predictive of who winds up being recruited into a cultic or high demand group. There's no studies that sort of show that,
yep,
you know, this psychological profile or these ACE, you know, scores or something like mm-hmm. that, or this kind of family background. There's nothing like that. I'm pretty sure that NXIVM did a good job of showing the diversity of recruits. How people could come from middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class, educated backgrounds, people with low ACE scores, people with high ACE scores, people with trauma, people with no trauma.
Yes.
That whole question, I'm kind of like on a hobby horse with this now. What I want to reframe that question is not how did you join, but what social determinants existed for you that made your experience in this group or that group catastrophic or something that was tolerable? Because what I've found, you know, 6 years of formal research of this now and doing all kinds of investigative yes. journalism on it, is that the question isn't like, why were you vulnerable enough to get involved? But it's more like, once you were there, what were the resources that you had to leave? And where did they come from? Because it's not like you enter the cult, you sign a contract. I mean, the strange thing is you guys did in many levels, right?
We signed an NDA.
It was a slow indoctrination. But I like what you're saying, because I'm allergic to like, well, were you vulnerable? I wasn't. I've had to
reframe that question.
Yeah, I was in New York. I was auditioning. You know, I had a friend kind of wear me down. I go, fine, I'll give it a shot.
Right.
Like, it wasn't like, you know, and it had to do with goal setting.
But it also is important, I think has been for both of us in our healing journey, to look at what was going on for us. And I like that social determinants.
Well, I think it's more when you were in. Isn't that what you're saying, Matthew? Once you were in, what kept you there so much is...
I'm saying both. And the social determinants are situational, right? Because what we do know from the research is not that there are psychological predictors, but rather there are situational predictors.
Yes.
People who just went through a divorce, people who are on a gap year in education, people who have been auditioning for 6 months and they've gotten nothing, people who had a death in the family, you've been diagnosed with cancer. These are things that happen to every human being. At one point or another. And that situational vulnerability has to run into the hook of somebody like Keith Raniere in order for NXIVM to work. Right?
Yes. And at the right time.
At the right time. Yeah. And that's why not everybody is recruited. That's why Keith doesn't want everybody. That's why we can't really think about it as like, why did you join that team?
It takes a year, because at a certain point of knowing someone, they're going to have a moment where they have a relationship or they're something, and then you just say something at the right time. You know, I had a friend of mine who knew I was doing it, asked me some questions about it, and was no. And then one day says, yo, I want to try that thing. And then he did the whole thing. And he's like, look, I was thinking of suicide before I took that. Thank you.
Right.
And that was it. That was all he did. And I had no idea that he had anything going on with him like that. And
right.
He just kind of knew that I was doing this and it helped him. And he peaced out. And that was fine.
Can I add one thing too, which is that I'm turning 50 this year. I don't know about you guys. Are you a few
43.
Years? 43. You're a few years younger.
43 and okay. 46.
43, 46. Yeah. Okay. So let's also just keep in mind that I basically come into my professional life during a collapse of the previous economy, in the sense that globalization is happening. The service industry is taking over. Anybody, like, I grew up with parents who, you know, it's natural for me to go into the humanities and to study English and music and stuff like that. There's nothing for me to do. There's a shrinking job market, and there's also the rise of a kind of gig culture in which people are inventing professions.
Yeah.
They are inventing economies. And it's not just because, and it's not just because they're creative. It's also because people have to make work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything about your backstory, Nippy, but you're saying I wasn't vulnerable. I was auditioning. I got involved. It was about optimizing this or that. But, I mean, in that circumstance, we're talking about a larger sort of cultural and political economic vulnerability that allows an organization like NXIVM to believe that it's a fucking thing, right?
Right.
Actually slide into... What does it actually do, right? Like it's coaching for, I mean, yes, people want to become more confident and they want to like look at their limitations and whatever, but there's something about it that's also like, it wouldn't exist if globalization didn't happen and there was no such thing as, you know, manufacturing anymore, if labor unions hadn't collapsed in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's also a larger picture here.
Yes.
That means that, and this is even more salient when we look at how does cultism expand and proliferate in the digital age, when all of those forces of, you know, the fragmentation of labor and the gig economy become that much more acute, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are people going to do except make shit up to sort of try to sell online? And so that's a huge influence.
100%. And then it even accelerated. Like when I joined in 2005, it was the zeitgeist of like hashtag boss babe.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
Hadn't even like that came out later. And then there was a whole new rush of, you know, be the best version of yourself bullshit, which I just, you know, makes me want to gag now. But I think in that way, Keith was a little ahead of his time.
Totally.
And then also, right? Like he was presenting this and then it took off, but it was also behind. Like here's something that was a bit of a head fuck for me. And one of the ways I was able to eventually wake up, there were so many inconsistencies. So one of the things was, this is a success program. I signed up for executive success programs. And then when I hit success and having, you know, being able to buy my first home or, you know, booking an acting job, then it was, but now you're attached. It was a problem that I had an attachment and that I was choosing my comfort or choosing my relationship over growth or something. So I was always in the state of confusion being like, but I thought I was supposed to achieve my goals. But if I achieve my goals and I have an attachment to my goals, then that's a problem. Like,
well, it's a really interesting carrot that he waved because it seems to be about empowerment and it seems mm-hmm. to be about, you know, self-sufficiency. But if you really got that from NXIVM, you would go, you would leave, right?
Yes.
How couldn't the next part of the gig be, well, actually, you want to be able to transcend the success that you won through the program and that I offered you, because that's not my real lesson. I mean, that's like famous bait and switch stuff where like...
Such a bait and switch.
Well, yours was different because you started pursuing a career. I was there for a year and a half, left.
Well, everyone's bait and switch was a little bit different, but ultimately the overall bait and switch is come here and we'll help you grow. But then you get there and you realize that you're broken and they're offering the tools to fix you and you can only get it there.
Yes. And if you fix yourself, we're going to break you again, actually, into the next level.
Yes. Yes. Right? For level two.
Right. Right. And in order to acclimatize the member to that, there's got to be early on this ethos set up where, you know, challenge that is painful, that is going to bear your soul or that's going to humiliate you actually is a sign of growth.
Right.
And so all of the principles of kind of like spiritual abuse have to be instilled right at the ground floor in order for that, the pyramid scheme of the marketing of, you know, subsequent courses to work.
Right. It's the no pain, no gain thing, which you said something about in one of your episodes, and I wrote it down about specifically in regards to yoga, because that's your area of expertise. Pain is an initiation purification ritual.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I was like, oh my God, that's totally what they were doing with DOS and the branding.
For sure. Oh yeah.
Right?
I mean, one thing we can credit Keith with is his like almost perfect replication of classic techniques of mind-body control. Let me just pause here because I just want to acknowledge that, Sarah, you're a survivor of this. So we're talking about the branding, and I just want to acknowledge that this happened to you. And I don't want to talk about you like you're an object or something.
Thank you. And just so you know, I've had it removed. So I'm very like psychologically sound around it.
Right, right.
And I appreciate your sensitivity about that. So just know you can.
Thank you, Matt.
I really do, because some people forget that.
What was great about the reveal in the vow as well was, not only do a number of you become aware of what the branding actually is, but then you realize that it's actually the initials. So what could be more of a sign of transcendent testing of a follower than to actually be remolded in the image of the leader? Like, what could be, and to have that process be a threshold that he doesn't even sell to the participants. He coaches the participants to sell to each other. John Jalalich, I think, has gone on record in saying this, that she hasn't seen anything so meticulously evil and precise as what Keith was able to do. For all of the pain that was caused to you and others, there is some kind of sort of public benefit in that being visible, I think, because there's something about how perfectly symbolic it is of what the high demand group leader actually does, that it represents some sort of peak ownership and testing of commitment through pain.
Yes.
It's just extraordinary. It's extraordinary that the world actually has access and can say, that's the sort of peak expression of, you know, charismatic and cultic abuse.
Yes. 2 points on that. One is that I spoke to a former member of Keith's inner circle or harem that got out before DOS, and she shared with me that hearing about what our practices were in terms of being ready and in terms of like the readiness drills and in terms of the things that we had to do for DOS, she said, oh, that was my life in NXIVM as being part of the inner circle, and there was no DOS. It was all the same things.
Right. Right.
That she had given him nude photos. And all of those things she said were, that was just part of the culture of being in his inner circle.
He just
formulated it and made it. I think he realized that people were leaving and they weren't going to be loyal. And he's like, I got to lock this shit down. And then created all these things. I'm sure he researched all these other groups. And when I actually read Janja Lalich's book about the different types of cults,
right,
religious and large group awareness trainings, there's also one about the occult. And I was like, oh, he went into the occult realm with the branding.
Right.
And the other thing I wanted to say in regards to what the branding meant and how, yes, I agree, it was what the world needed to see. And it's in terms of research and understanding how these things work. And that being the metaphor, it reminded me of this one person who left, who was still in, and I believe is still in, who reached out to me, a former dear friend of mine from Mexico, who called me and was like, well, I don't understand what's so bad about it. And I was like, I have been branded. And he was like, I don't even know what that means. Like, is it a translation? I'm like, it's what farmers do to their cattle to say that the cattle is property of the farmer. I'm not property of Keith.
Right.
And he said, well, it's only that if you make it mean that.
Oh.
Which is, that was the typical gaslighting.
Right.
Oh my God, my blood just boiled just even talking about it. But we watched Yellowstone recently. Have you seen that show?
I have not, no.
It's a good show. We're just at the beginning of it, but it's a ranch, and the owner of the ranch has this Y brand that's like a stamp that he puts into his cattle, and he also puts it into the cow hands, like the cowboys.
Oh.
But they decide, like, if you're going to be here, you're here for life, and you get the Y burnt into your flesh with a stamp, which, by the way, I think is much more humane than one which was done to us in a slow 30-minute process without anesthetic. So watching that, it was a bit triggering, but also it helped me really see at a bigger scale what he was doing. I'm putting my initials on the bodies of all these women.
Right.
You are mine forever. This is a lifetime commitment.
Right. And I'm going to do it with a secret symbol that will only unfold itself over time. Right.
Yes. They actually thought that we weren't going to figure it out.
Hmm.
They were hoping to keep it from the women that were below the initial. There was the top line women who were under Keith who were all with him.
Right.
And they were stoked about having his initials on their body. But I think they knew that it wasn't going to go over well. So they did a hidden symbol and they didn't think we'd figure it out.
Yes. And yet the narcissism of the gesture can't bear hiding it. Right. It would have to leave a clue. It would have to leave a clue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, right. I think Keith was very proud of this scheme that you're right. Very systematically came up with, and that ultimately was many things that were problematic over time, but recognizing it.
You had asked about pain, and I just want to sort of normalize that as a cultic technique that is actually quite well recognized within the yoga world. I wrote a whole book about the fact that Patabi Joyce, who was the founder of something called Ashtanga Yoga, which is probably responsible for, I would say half of the popular yoga in the world at this point. He actually physically and sexually assaulted his students every day of his working career under the guise of quote unquote adjustments. Now, the sexual assaults were clear enough, although people denied them and rationalized and spiritualized them. But probably even more pervasive was the physical assaulting that actually equated his touch, his sort of manipulation of the students' bodies and the pain that would come from that with a kind of transformative experience. Mm-hmm. So people began to actively talk about the pain that they went through physically in class as being signs of transformation, of the body remaking itself, of energy flowing in a new way, of fear being released or what have you. So that's not an uncommon principle. Bikram Chowdhury has the same language in his so-called teaching as well, the founder of Hot Yoga.
Right. Well, we watched that documentary and I mean, it's like there's this, I think Yanya Lalich calls it the cookie cutter messiah template complex, right? It's the same practices, right?
I found that in my recovery process, it was really, really helpful. I mean, it's depressing on one hand to see the cookie cutter patterning, but it also kind of depersonalizes the process.
Yes.
And it allows cult survivors to see that, oh, these are recognizable social dynamics. They pop up in various places. I was not stupid, you know, and sort of caught up in a unique situation. I think Alexandra Stein says that the three people who you want to talk to as a cult survivor are people who used to be in your same group, and you can share stories, people who used to be in similar groups, so you can compare the patterns, and then people who used to know you before you were in. people who can hold some kind of memory of who you were where all the changes took place.
And get back to your former authentic self.
Matthew, I have a question for you. One of the things I love about, you know, what I've researched on you is how you articulate things. And one of the things I'd love to hear you address is the things that I was most astounded with when this thing started to come out in the media was the arrogance with which Keith doubled down on and still does with his belief. You know, there was even a point where he released a media statement saying he had nothing to do with DOS, in spite of text messages, emails that said that he founded it, originated, and an actual recording of saying that he of directions of how to administrate the brand. And then there was this New York Times magazine article where they had these bizarre pictures of him and Claire Bronfman in there that, like, and we at that point knew that he was going to get outed, because we knew basically from the investigation that the New York Times article was a lie. Like, we knew all this stuff. So if we felt like if we knew it, it was only a matter of time before the public did. And then even still during the trial, he didn't even defend himself. He tries to have a trial outside the trial, just the arrogance and the doubling down of, first of all, why? Like, what's the psychology behind that? Like, who's his audience? I mean, unless it's just the people that are loyal, or like, how do you explain that? I'm sure you've seen that in your domains as well, just the doubling down on their philosophies when they've been exposed.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that we, just as we don't really have psychological predictors for who gets recruited into cults, we don't have good psychological profiles for cult leaders, because they don't go to therapy. They don't, you know, submit to psychiatric evaluation in any kind of public way. It's really hard. It's really hard to guess at the internal working of somebody who seems to exhibit constant, accelerating, expanding sociopathy. It's like, it's very difficult to say what's going on. But I kind of anticipated this question as well, because I can't imagine the two of you living through that experience and not having this thing haunt you, this question, like, well, what was going on for him? Like, what was he actually trying to do? And while we don't really have good answers for that, you know, Dan Shaw helped you out, Sarah, but did you read his book, Traumatic Narcissism?
I think I read part of it and some of his articles.
You can ask him about this and say hello to him for me.
Sure.
But here's the sort of key quote. He says, "This narcissist in real life, a myth in his own mind, is so well defended against his developmental trauma, so skillful a disavower of the dependency and inadequacy that is so shameful to him, that he creates a delusional world in which he is a superior being in need of nothing he cannot provide for himself. To remain persuaded of his own perfection, he uses significant others whom he can subjugate. These spouses, siblings, children, or followers of the inflated narcissist strive anxiously to be what the narcissist wants them to be for fear of being banished from his exalted presence. He is compelled to use those," I love this, "he's compelled to use those who depend on him to serve as hosts for his own disavowed and projected dependency, which for him signifies profound inadequacy and is laden with shame and humiliation.
to the extent that he succeeds in keeping inadequacy and dependency external, he can sustain in his internal world his delusions of shame-free, self-sufficient superiority. So according to that, my answer to your question of why does he double down is because he can't fucking help it, right? It's like he is hanging on by his nails. If he gives an inch, he is psychologically destroyed. If he if he walks back just a single bit and takes one tiny look in the mirror, he would be annihilated. That's according to Dan Shaw. And that's the that's the best speculation I've got. Dan doesn't know either, right? Like psychoanalyzing these people from afar is really it's difficult to do. But he's spent his life sort of meditating on this, and I think that's a really good answer.
And psychoanalysis requires inner honesty. And
absolutely.
And these people, there's no inner honesty.
It's actually the foundation of the human psychology, Nippy.
That's
a line from our mission statement, ironically.
And he's sitting in jail for 120 years and he hasn't given that inch that you talk about. So
no, he can't, because he'll implode with the depth of his shameful wound, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. If you just imagine having a regular sort of within normal parameters human moral compass, getting a memo where it was displayed to you that, you know, here are the acts of Keith Raniere and this is what you've done to people, and saying, oh yeah, I did that. And that was really, that really hurt people. Imagine the moment that happens would just be absolutely, utterly unbearable. It's very plausible to me that it can't, that it just can't. He has to look at the piece of paper. He's read the charges and the conviction, right? The files are open for the entire fucking world to see. Everybody can see his messages, right?
Yes.
It's not like there's anything hidden. So, so it just tells me that it is impossible for him to give even a quarter of an inch. And it's hard to imagine a life like that, because how empty, how soulless, how incapable of loving or receiving love it is. But I don't want to spend too much time empathizing.
Yeah.
No. But I want to circle back to something, because
you circling back?
I'm circling back. Wow. Something we ask all of our guests who generally are cult survivors or turned experts, therapists, whatever, in your case, researcher and expert and so many things. But what was it specifically, if you don't mind sharing, that woke you up and how you got out of your groups?
I had two different moments. They were similar with both. And they were both about seeing the leaders almost stripped of their clothes all in one moment. I traveled around the world with Michael Roach, and he taught in a bunch of places, and I did a bunch of sort of content production work for him that never came to anything. At one point, he was addressing an audience in Singapore, and he had a translator, but he didn't speak in English. He spoke in literally like cartoon Fu Manchu Chinglish to this audience. He was like in grade five pretending to be a Chinese immigrant, as though that would ingratiate him to his audience. And I sat there and realized that he had no idea where he was. He had no idea who he was talking to, and he had no idea how offensive it was. And it showed me a sort of level of his sort of narcissistic preoccupation that I hadn't seen before. And after that, I was completely, utterly disgusted. It was like a moment of total insulting, deception revealing performance.
Yeah.
And then the second one with Charles Anderson, he would give these ecstatic prayer sessions every morning. And, you know, there was people doing kind of like Kundalini jitterbug at the end, and you know, lots of trance dancing, and there was a lot of sort of emotional contagion involved in those prayer meetings every morning. And when they ended, he would go upstairs in the building, and you could, if you wanted to have a private audience with him, there was no real order to it, or there was no gatekeeper or anything like that. If you had the courage, you could go up the stairs and ask him a question or something. And I remember for some reason I wanted to ask him something, and I happened to be up there first, which was very odd and kind of eerie. The building that we were in was this old 1950s hotel that was kind of falling down and that the cult had bought, and terrible like carpeting, and just it was smelly.
Sound
and
familiar.
It was smelly and gross. Yeah. And like Nexium was very much upgraded from that. I entered his room And I opened the door, and to the right, just like in a hotel room, there was the bathroom was there. And I turned around the corner and I saw him. And I saw him looking in the mirror with this like incredibly disgusted, depressed face. He was literally, it was like he was saying to himself, "What are you doing? What are you,
wow,
what are you doing with yourself? Why are you doing this?" And I said, "Master teacher, can I talk to you?" Right. And then I literally saw him in the mirror, look at himself and put his magic face, googly eyes back on. And then he turned to me and he was back in character. And I was like,
wow.
I was like, "Holy shit, who are you?" Right. What is going on here? Because he presented as this kind of wild, crazy man, and he broke character, and I saw it. That was a key moment. But I mean, both of those moments, like I was saying earlier, that we have to look at the social determinants that allow people to get out, as well as those that keep people in.
Yes.
You know, both of those moments were very striking, but damn, it takes a long time after your eyes are opened to reorganize your financial and emotional and social and even geographical life in order to begin to differentiate from the group. That was still a year before I left. I was like checked out after that.
Right.
But I didn't have the resources to leave.
A lot of people who ask, I mean, I've done so many interviews since leaving, don't understand. They're like, "Well, you didn't wake up when you were branded." I was like, "No. In fact, I was proud of myself at the time for getting through it and for getting through it without moving. I did better than any of the other women who were flipping around on the table like electrocuted fish. I was proud of myself."
That was never going to fly with me.
No, and of course not. But what I'm saying, that didn't wake me up.
You were prepared for months prior to that particular abuse. The whole question, didn't the branding wake you up, really does not understand an indoctrination process that actually predicts how you're going to respond to the pain, which is opposite to your best interests, actually, right?
Yes.
That's what you've been trained to do.
I was just realizing when you spoke that I don't think I ever saw Keith break character. The only time I saw him not guru-esque was, and there's a photo of him in the back of the police car after he was arrested, and he just looks so
pissed. I have
pissed.
Seen that photograph, and I think you're right. It was
the
something distinctly different. And the trial photographs, he didn't have that. It was like the moment where he's busted, that broke the mask for a little bit.
But I also, the only time I saw him different than what we saw was actually in The Vow, which was hard to watch because there's all this behind the scene footage of him laying on a couch surrounded by these women that, you know, and that was part of our,
honestly, like,
we were so pissed.
Drunk frat boy.
Yeah. Like,
just, I'd never seen it.
We didn't see it, but that part wasn't presented to us.
That must be so wild for you to see that, footage. And it's like, I just want to say that you're both in a very pressurized position. I mean, the tagline for your podcast is we're learning or we're recovering in public.
Yes.
And, you know, I want to thank you for doing that, but I also want to acknowledge that that's just not normal.
No, it's not.
For you to have to, not only be exposed to way more information than most cult survivors are exposed to, but then also have the process of being exposed itself be recorded. That's wild. So I hope you're taking a lot of time off.
Probably it's not as much as we should, but when we do, we go, "Oh God, we got to do more of this because it's important," which is actually our next question. Nippy, you want to ask that?
Oh, wound care. Yeah. It's Q4 on our list. So we just wanted to get you to elaborate on wound care. Do you think the healing process is ever over? And what helps you tend to your ongoing emotional well-being while you're doing the work?
You know, I asked Steve Hassan this question, and because one of the problems that I think cult researchers, and now I've moved into the sort of disinformation field as I've become, you know, somebody who does journalism on QAnon and stuff like that, is that there's something called Brandolini's Law, which is that the amount of time it takes to refute bullshit is an order of magnitude larger than the time it takes to make it. And so I think that for people who were well embedded in cultic dynamics, the time of recruitment requires a lot of care on the other side. I don't know that it's 10 to 1 or an order of magnitude, but there's a couple of points of despair in my life, actually, where there's always more surviving cult members than there are therapists. available.
Yes.
There is always more wreckage from cultic dynamics and organizations than can be repaired. It is very rare, and this is one of the reasons that NXIVM is so interesting, I think, internationally. It's very rare that there is either criminal or civil accountability for any of these groups. And, you know, there's a lot of investigative journalism that I've done into groups that hasn't really made a dent in how they operate. There's that as well. And it's possible, since there was so much media over the years about Keith, it's possible that without the branding and without the trafficking being revealed and without media attention, which I understand from the vow was kind of touch and go with regard to whether the New York Times was going to pursue it.
Right.
It's possible that he could have continued. That's a plausible world in which he's still doing what he's doing. In disinformation terms, the capacity of a single actor like Ron Watkins to spin out, you know, cue drops for 2.5 years and send millions of people into a fever dream, you know, along with the grifters on YouTube who are boosting it. It's amazing how little effort it takes to disrupt people's lives and how much care it takes to put them back together. That's something that I really struggle with as a researcher. But as I struggle with it, I think it aids in my own recovery, right? Because as Steve Hassan said, I can't not do what I'm doing because I was so helped by the people, by Robert J. Lifton and the people who helped me get out of the Moonies. I was so helped. My life was changed. I was saved by people who were able to understand what I went through. And then he tells this amazing story about how his neighbor, his elderly family neighbor, this old woman in the neighborhood, when he finally came back after 2.5 years as a recruiter for the Moonies, she just came by with cookies one day and looked him in the eye and said, "We're glad you're back. Here's some cookies." And he has carried that forward for 40 years. I guess I just try to really focus on the positive feedback and the small victories that happen when people get insights into their cultic experience. And then also, you know, we get a lot of positive feedback on the podcast from people who will say that, well, I have been in these kind of conspirituality circles for a long time, and I'm finally seeing, you know, the kind of manipulation that I've been exposed to. That's good. But personally, yeah, I don't think that having your time and your body and your emotional labor and your altruism, especially your altruism, stolen from you for years.
Yeah.
I don't know that ever goes away. I think that the only way that gets sort of turned into something positive is when the person, you know, is able to really fathom the depth of it and say, I'm never going to let that happen to anybody else.
Once it becomes wisdom.
The amount of altruism. There's somebody, I forget who the legal specialist is, who says this. I think he said it in a podcast with Rachel Bernstein, who I'd highly recommend. She interviewed this guy who's been working on how can we deal with the fact that our legal system really isn't set up in any way to evaluate undue influence. The reason that Keith gets caught is because there are federal offenses, criminal offenses involved. But for the most part, what cults do is not illegal, because the premise is that, you know, adults are consenting, and if they want to, you know, if they want to devote their lives to an MLM, then they're free to do that. But he said something that's always haunted me, which is that the cult steals away from you your altruism, the best part of you, the thing that wants to help people, the thing that wants to, you know, experience more or be more in love with life. That's what it actually commodifies.
And Lana Yalich has, I think she calls it the moral injury.
Yeah, it's the moral injury. Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, Matthew, you touched on something that I've noticed in just doing 7 podcasts and talking to a handful of people, to your point about the legal system. To take it a step further, there are certain cultic, or, you know, a little bit culty domains that actually have legislation that protects them.
Yeah, I'm not so familiar with that. I'm not surprised, though.
Well, Scientology has the First Amendment and the religion one. And then I think the MLM one had something where the lobbyists were protecting right. them.
We just did an MLM episode, so our last one.
It's been really interesting to see that, you know, there are things. And hopefully, you know, our story is something that informs legislation going forward as well.
There are stories that as they become public, make the limitations of our legal and journalistic frameworks yeah. really clear. Like, I don't know if, you know, well, you're both in Canada, so you probably remember the Gian Gomeshi yes. story. Yeah. So he is credibly accused of sexual assault by several people. There's a trial. And what does it come down to? What is the trial about? The trial is about attempting to prove sexual assault in very narrow windows of time. And the details are all about whether the plaintiff can prove that she remembers what color his fucking car was. Ugh. And like all of these like nitpicking details around, did he actually do this and when? And you start to realize that the story that actually allows Gian Gomeshi to do what he does is a story of networked enablement at the CBC for a decade or more, where basically everybody is aware of how he treats people. Everybody is aware of the power dynamics in the room. And what ends up getting reported on is these criminal instances. It's our legal frameworks focus in on the details that they can actually deal with, and they don't actually have a sense of or the tools to say, okay, well, there's a network of complicity mm-hmm. here that actually allows this to happen. But once in a while, we get reporting like Ronan Farrow's reporting on Harvey Weinstein that shows very clearly how many enablers were involved. And I think that's pretty clear in the reporting on
yes,
Keith, too.
His inner circle was his enabling flying monkey team of basically pimps for him. And I didn't right, understand right. that until I read actually Rose McGowan's book, Brave, and which talks about her experience with Harvey. Ronan would Farrow would be definitely one of our dream guests as well. Sidebar. Just a quick sidebar. We were still in when the Gian Gomeshi scandal happened. And we talked about it because we were talking about these things in the Jeunesse SOP curriculum. And the way that Keith had us thinking about it was that, you know, basically protecting his own non-consent beliefs, I guess, is the best way I could put it. So I at the time saw it as what he framed as, well, these are clearly jilted lovers, you know, women who didn't get what they wanted from him. And now they're conspiratorizing against him to take him down.
And he probably framed that as being tragic yeah. from their point of view psychologically because they were indulging their
yes,
victimhood.
100%.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Right. And so they weren't actually empowered enough to say, oh, I made a mistake. Actually, I really did want to engage in non-consensual BDSM with Gian Gomeshi. Yeah. And so really it's my fault and I should own that. And then I'll be powerful. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the main nuggets at the end of the Jeunesse training was when a victim cries that they've been abused, that is the actual abuse.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah. yeah. Complete twisting. And I think one of the things that is so incredibly eerie and haunting about that scenario is the way in which that itself is framed as a kind of feminist empowerment.
Yeah. yeah totally. 100%.
I mean, unbelievable skill on Rainier's yep. part and sociopathy.
Exactly.
Incredible.
And it's also why they believed that they needed DOS to actually empower women and to prevent people like Sarah, who was just having a tantrum for not, you know, maintaining her commitment. And that's the worst right. of a female trait. We did want to talk about language and looking at some of the cult definitions. And if quickly you could help us look at which ones are which need to change. One of our listeners actually wrote to me or to us saying that I had said something about, you know, they're still drinking the Kool-Aid and that it wasn't sensitive to what had happened in Jonestown. And first of all, I want to acknowledge that was very not sensitive of me to recognize that I was doing that. And I think that I'm guilty of what I think a lot of people do, which is there's this term to explain brainwashing or undue influence, and they call it drinking the Kool-Aid, which is actually not accurate, because drinking the Kool-Aid is what, or the Flavor Aid is what happened at the end of Jonestown when they were forced to basically poison themselves.
It's Flavor Aid.
And it Flavor Aid. Yeah, it's not honoring of those people who died, and it's not sensitive. Anyway, things like that. Yeah.
Although it's a really, I'm glad that you brought it up, because it's a really sort of illustrative point with regard to how the culture in general, pop culture in general, looks at cult survivors. Yes. As being gullible children who want something sticky and sweet and who are willing to sort of just guzzle down whatever they're right. given. And it's infantilizing. And I think that it really shows the kind of level of fear and contempt that popular culture holds towards the cult survivor. I think because deep down there's a fear that, oh, well, it could be me too.
Right. You mentioned earlier also prosperity gospel in relation to yogic cults. And we are going to do a full episode on a yoga cult. Now, since I've started my research, I realize every yoga group has a history of abuse, it seems like.
Pretty much. Yeah. In the modern era. Yeah.
To be clear, I have been practicing yoga for 20 years, but I've never been in deep into a group. I've done a little bit of Bikram. I've tried Ashtanga. I've tried Asara. I loved the Jivamukti Center in New York, but I found it weird. I liked their cafe. and since stepping back and looking at it, going, wow, there's all these abuses. But prosperity gospel seems to be a part of all of them. And also I relate that to NXIVM, in that there's this promise of wealth. Is that how you define it as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think technically prosperity gospel emerges from a brand of kind of suburban evangelical Christian megachurch culture in the state that associates wealth with blessedness and being chosen and so
Got
on.
It.
But my sense is that with an organization like NXIVM, that becomes much more sophisticated and kind of woven into the general corporate notion that, you know, those who live their best life or those who really give 110% are, you know, destined really to have a kind of success. And if they're not, then they're doing something wrong. Then they have to get clear with, you know, with their inner psychology or their demons or their
sophisticated
God.
And yet also crude. Nippy, do you remember when in sales meetings, Keith would encourage us to find more people like myself, a good recruiter, and he'd refer to it as finding the money pump.
At least he said the quiet part out loud, right? He made it really
yes.
clear.
Nip, you want to ask number five?
Sure. Q5, the ethics of cult journalism. What needs to change about the way survivors and cult members are covered by journalists? What are journalism schools missing in ethics 101?
I don't know about journalism schools, but I know that everything has to slow down, first of all. The process of reporting on cultic dynamics is really delicate. It's easy to sensationalize. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to focus in on dramatic interpersonal dyad stories between the abusive leader and the, you know, the damaged victim. It's very easy to, you know, focus on the psychology of the survivor or the psychology of the leader, mm-hmm. and to really miss the sort of slow networked process by which a person is drawn into, you know, a social dynamic that really begins to impact every aspect of their lives. So I think a lot of it is a function of slowing down, allowing sources to develop as they speak to each other. And I think, too, that if you're not a cult survivor and you're doing reporting, you should talk to cult survivors who are outside of your
yes.
story.
Great idea.
Interview them about how they would have liked to be interviewed. Mm-hmm. Just as kind of like a reality testing, character building exercise. Because if you don't do that, you're going to be walking into a series of presumptions about whether or not the person is acting in their best interest, or whether or not they're making free choices, or whether or not they're consenting to what they're doing. And all of those things are really put into question by basic cultic dynamics. So I think the other thing that is super, super important is that, as with Me Too reporting, the survivor has to be foregrounded in terms of what they're comfortable in disclosing, and it has to be precise, right? it's really not a good scene when the survivor is surprised by something that winds up in print or is misquoted or, you know, or something's inaccurate.
Those are very good points.
And I do want to say that all of those sort of best practices that I'm describing, maybe journalism professors would disagree with me in the sense that I'm coming at this as kind of an activist. But that's because I know something about what these organizations are, and I know that they are generally not reported on very well because the focus is usually on individual stories and psychologies.
Right. Quickly, in regards to ethics and journalism, do you, and also a podcast expert, we are learning, do you have any advice for us as we get deeper into it?
That's great. I think you're in a really unique position because in so many ways, you are overexposed to the media. And in some ways, I know that that overexposure means that there are certain things that also nobody knows that have been missed. And you will also have, you know, hidden and private lives. So it's a, I'm sure it's a very strange position to be in. I would say that if you really take time, I'm not your therapist, but
it's okay. We asked.
But just imagining that I'm in your position, really take time with the acknowledging the strangeness of being a public figure disclosing private stuff and speaking with other people who are bridging that same gap, because I think that it could become more complicating than less complicating as you progress, especially if the vow you become even more public type figures. You're now in a media environment, but you're also doing something that is sort of borderline therapeutic. And I think being aware of where all of those lines are and being really clear about what you don't know and basically doing everything that Keith didn't teach you to do with regard to scope of practice and, like, you know, not overreaching, that's all going to be really important going forward.
Awesome. That's really helpful.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do one more thing very quickly, which is a segment. It's the humorous part of our segment, which is called What Chaps My Ass? And Nippy and I often remember crazy things that happen in Nexium that really chaps our asses. And I'll give you an example that relates to your background, which is that, as I said, I practice yoga. At Vanguard Week, we used to do yoga on the dock as a, not a spiritual thing, but more of an exercise practice. And when XOSO was invented towards the end of my tenure in Nexium, which was his own mishmash of yoga, Pilates, and other whatever. It was like an emotional dance thing. And anyway, I personally hated it because I just didn't like, I like my yoga. I like to do my thing. And we were then banned from doing yoga as soon as XOSO was involved. And it was not honorable of what Keith had created. So anyway, that...
Of course yeah, you were.
That chaps my ass. Do you have a quick chaps your ass story about one of your cults?
No, it's two different affects that come to mind. One is, they both give me the willies, intrusive eye contact.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so that's one thing. And the other thing is male, charismatic, word salad, trance speech. Whenever I hear that start revving up, I feel nauseous. I want to start to gnaw my arm off.
I hear you. I loved your conspirituality Instagram posts about alternative tea bags from the. In fact, I didn't know that those tea bags supported the Kundalini market. I'm not going to buy those anymore. I didn't realize that's what it was. So thank you for informing us and being a part of, you know, team education here. I feel like we found an ally in you.
Well, it's a pleasure. I think you're doing something important. And thanks so much for the great questions.
Yeah, thanks for your time, Matthew. Yeah, we're definitely going to have him on again, right, Sarah?
Yes, absolutely. Do you think he could be our yoga
guy? He's going to be all things yoga, I think.
I still don't know which yoga group to do. Kundalini, Bikram, Ashtanga. We did speak to someone who says that Ashtanga is the one, like Bikram's fell apart. And then Kundalini is a very big lifestyle switch, whereas Ashtanga is the one where it's still going strong despite abuses being reported. Stay tuned for that episode. And
yeah, this is our penultimate episode in season one. We have one more episode coming up, and then we're going to be taking a short break to get lined up for season two. So thanks everyone for making this happen.
Yeah, we need a minute to regroup and plan and research. There's just been so many ideas thrown at us, and we really appreciate that. And we want to make sure that we give each episode our due diligence. And also, I'm doing a movie for Hallmark.
Hollywood calls.
It's the dichotomy of my life. A little bit of cult stuff, a little bit of Hallmark. It all rounds itself out in the end, don't you think?
Balance, Sarah.
Mm-hmm. And Nippy's putting his honey-sounding vocals down on tape for some voice work. Circling back to that.
Ace and Troy want spring training. That's really why we're taking 3 weeks off. They want to get into training.
Okay. And yeah, they're going to crush the crypto thing, learning after his dad.
I'm going to definitely just bring him into the crypto world, get him to get some MFTs out there, non-fungible tokens, per Jess Tardy's request.
And we'll be circling back with guests from season one and some bonus guests over Instagram Live. So keep an eye out for that. If you're not following us on Instagram, we are a little bit culty. Well, not we are a little bit. Well,
I mean,
that's the handle.
Yeah.
So we're not going radio silent by any means. We'll be around just regrouping.
I might go radio silent. I might.
But hey.
We made a podcast.
We made a podcast. 11
episodes, and everyone listening made it possible. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for the reviews. Thanks for the stars.
Cue music.
Cue the music. See you later. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. We're going to be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors and sometimes experts who are survivors and some familiar faces from The Vow.
If you got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what got me to this point, my memoir, Scarred, the true story of how I escaped Nexium, the cult that bound my life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and wherever books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Like literally take their phone out and press subscribe.
5 stars. That's 5 of them.
We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames. Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. Additional original music is composed by Will Rutherford.
We'll be back with more episodes. Until then,
don't join a cult. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.